listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I am roughly one of 20% of Americans, according to the Pew Research Center, who has a relative married to someone of another race. By 2050, my grandnephew, Henry Huckleberry Solomon, the first time I've said it from the podium, son of a Jewish American and a father and an East Indian mother, and Henry Huckleberry has just begun crawling, will be hitting his stride. According to sociologists at UC Irvine, by 2050, mixed-race people could account for 1 in 5 Americans, and the result, as Joel Kotkin points out, will be a U.S. best described in Walt Whitman's prophetic phrase as the race of races. No other advanced populous country will enjoy such ethnic diversity, and much of our country's power will, according to Kotkin, stem from its status as the world's only multiracial superpower. Futurist, columnist, and author Joel Kotkin envisions America at 2050 as the most affluent, culturally rich, and successful nation in human history. Set against ethnic conflicts, low birth rates, and increasing homogeneity in the rest of the world, America, says Kotkin, will defy the naysayers to become a more bountiful, multiracial society powered by land, localism, green technology, and our defiant indigenous spirit. I love that. Okay, so I want to know more, and I think you will too. So we're delighted to host Joel Kotkin tonight in conversation with historian Kevin Starr to discuss his new book, The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. Joel Kotkin is an internationally recognized authority on global economic, political, social, and technological trends. He's the author of 6 books, including The City, A Global History, and The New Geography, How the Digital Revolution is Reshaping the American Landscape. He writes regular columns for Forbes and contributes to many publications, including The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. He's a leading expert on the evolution of cities, towns, and rural places, and has written major reports on the future of New York, St. Louis, Los Angeles, suburban Montreal, and the Inland Empire region of Southern California. He's currently a senior fellow at the Center for the Urban Future. Dr. Kevin Starr, one of America's great historians, and I hereby nominate him for a national treasure, is the State Librarian Emeritus of California and University Professor and Professor of History at USC. He's written 10 books, 6 of which are part of his Americans and the California Dream series. He's also written Coast of Dreams, California on the Edge, 1990 to 2003, and California, A History. His writing has won him many honors, including the Gold Medal of the Commonwealth Club of California, the Lifetime Achievement Award from Penn USA West, and the Centennial Medal of the Graduate School of Arts and Science at Harvard University. It is a great honor to welcome both Joel Kotkin and Kevin Starr to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that lovely introduction to each of us. And I will, since you gave a preface of the book already, I'll plunge in medias res.
But not before you pull your microphone.
Oh, I'll plunge in medias res to Joel Kotkin, whom I a good friend of mine and whom I've whose works I've read and whose column I follow. Joel, you've written an extraordinarily optimistic book dealing with the fact that the 100 million new Americans between now and 2050 does not necessarily imply Armageddon or collapse or catastrophe, but has filled with all sorts of wonderful possibilities.
Well, you know, I dedicated this book to my my 2 daughters who are 15 and 5. And I also, in a way, dedicated to my students at Chapman because I found my inspiration was them and other students and other young people who I think are being given an enormous disservice by our horrendous baby boom generation, which I'm a member of, in terms of saying, you know, the sense that America is coming to an end and almost a kind of nihilistic pleasure in seeing this. And the only good thing about being older is that I remember the same thing about 20 years ago. 20 years ago, it was assumed by all the leading lights that Japan was going to become the dominant world power, and the role of the United States was to go, you know, go on the side and, you know, do a good imitation of England. You know, we can all go to the pub and get drunk and stumble around Carnaby Street. And the fact of the matter is that the United States came back again, and that the United States has a lot of unique characteristics that many other countries and almost none of our major competitors have. And they're fundamentally shown by this demographic. And I don't think necessarily that, you know, everybody should go out and have 16 kids, but I think the fact that we are having children, that Americans are having children, that young people, if you look at the surveys of millennials, the vast majority want to get married, have kids. This is a sign of a society that can repair itself.
Well, you contrast that to Japan and to Italy, and in a very poignant paragraph, you say how a whole generation of young Italians today will grow up not knowing what it is to have a brother, a sister, a cousin, or even an uncle or an aunt. When you bring and that at the end of that zero population growth will be the necessity of bringing in all sorts of new immigrants, or Italy collapses, and that, and you use that as a sort of reverse paradigm for what we're doing. We're not doing that.
Right. I mean, we're not, again, our population growth rate will not be all that high, but, you know, you have a base of 300 million, you know, getting to 400 million, it won't be all that difficult. What is happening around the world in the advanced industrial world, and some people think that this is a sign of the United States being a regressive country, is the rest of the world is rapidly secularizing, in other words, losing all concern for religion, has become, in many places, the state has replaced the family as a source of succor. And there's a feeling that sort of humanity is almost a something that needs to be managed and in some cases to be reduced. I spend a lot of time in the United Kingdom, and this feeling is very deeply seated in that country now. Very deeply seated in Europe as well. And this sort of almost still the remnants, if you will, of a naive optimism about the future is still pretty well embedded in the American people, even though at this stage people are very pessimistic. The fact that their actions are saying, A, that I will have kids, but B, that my future is mine. It is determined by what I do. And this is probably one of the greatest contrasts with the Europeans today, is that America, most people still think what happens to in their life is going to be determined by them, as opposed by determined from the outside. And that gives me some hope. And so I think the United States is in a very strange position in the sense that we have, in many characteristics, we're a first world country, leading first world country, with attitudes that I see more often in India than I do in the United Kingdom or in Japan.
Joel, one of the patterns that you have that characterizes the entire book is this movement out from the center, this dispersion to the heartland. And you open the discussion of the heartland. After all, 100 million people have to be somewhere. And the question of where they're going to be is an important question that you address here. And you open up the discussion with it that in the early 90s they were predicting that the entire Midwest would be turned back to the buffalo, would be turned into a common ground range. You chronicle the trauma of the people of Fargo and North Dakota in the aftermath of the Coen Brothers film, where they even wanted to change the name of the state. They felt that it had been so. But you're talking about really a repeopling of the heartland with this new population.
Well, there are sort of two things that are going on. One is one of the fundamental strengths of the United States is our landmass. We are a big country. You know, whenever they say, "Well, we're running out of land," and my friend in Nebraska says, "Well, you know what? I want to push these people out of the plane in Nebraska, and then they'll land and they'll realize they don't see anybody for the next 3 hours as they're trudging along." As somebody who's hitchhiked through Kansas, I can tell you that. That does happen. But the fact of the matter is that the country is very large. It has lots of resources. And what's happening is with new technologies and with people saying, you know, I really don't have enough money to live in the coastal places, some of which I might want to live in. I could live in the middle part of the country. And so we're seeing actually population growth in places like Fargo and Sioux Falls. And it's funny, these places really changed. When I first started working in Fargo about 10, 15 years ago, the coffee was so bad, I took my own coffee with me. The food was beyond belief. And now there's a wonderful boutique hotel. There are several good restaurants. And they even have a store for metrosexuals. So we know that they're making progress.
Joe, if there's one city in this wonderful book that captures your imagination, it's Houston.
Yes.
And Houston is there at the beginning, and it comes back as a motif in terms of planning. It comes back as a motif in terms of cuisine. It comes back as a motif in terms of ethnic lines being erased and again and again, Houston. So you are obviously. I know you're a native New Yorker, and I know you know Los Angeles cold and where you live. But obviously, Houston has impressed you.
Well, you know, one of the things I feel sad about to some extent is when I moved to Los Angeles in '75, I thought that this was the place of the future, and I wrote my first book about California Inc., which was about the rise of California, and for about 15, 20 years, I was right. I mean, this was the future, and the energy that was here, if you remember Los Angeles in the 1980s, around the Olympics, but not really tied to the Olympics, but to the growth of the garment industry, the growth of the food processing industry, the real heyday of television and the movie industry in the city. And just the sense that the city was getting out of just being Tinseltown. It was beginning to become a serious place with great art and great culture and great architecture. And you see that now in Houston. You see the sense of the city coming into its own, people no longer apologizing for being here, in that city. And frankly, if I was 35 years old, I'd be very tempted to move to Houston, where you could buy a nice house, you could live in a nice neighborhood for a much lower price. With the money you save, you could buy a house on the beach here. And I think that this sense of the future and welcoming the some of the changes that have gone on. Houston now has a gay mayor. Houston is a very different city than you might imagine it from 20 or 30 years ago. And it's very similar to the trajectory of Los Angeles from the Sam Yorty period through the Tom Bradley period and to the Dick Reardon period.
Another city you like is Phoenix, probably for similar reasons.
Well, I think that these are places which are still affordable, where people can go and start again. L.A., now we may have an opportunity in the sense that some parts of L.A., now the housing prices have dropped. And I think L.A. still has the most potential of any city, but not with the current regulatory environment, not with the current political environment. It'd be very difficult to start a business here. Who would invest in Los Angeles right now? Who would invest in California right now? I think it would be a hard, something that's hard. I mean, even you look at we talk about the heartland, but California is an amazingly rich agricultural state. And there are many people who want to strangle our agricultural industries, which are one of the wonders of the world. And we're in a strange place in California. And why I suppose I was so attracted to Houston is they still had that spirit, that still had this notion that the future could be better than the past.
Joel, in my recent book, I talked about the creation of suburbs in the 1940s, 50s,
oh, yes,
the early 60s. And the hostility of intellectuals to the suburbs, to suburban life, it's not just Malvina Reynolds' "Ticky Tack" song. That's an obvious example. You acknowledge that, but you take a totally different tact. You have a very complex view of suburban development, past, present, and future. And maybe you could share some of that, because I think it's one of the real contributions in the book, among many.
Well, you know, one of the things that we have to understand is the original idea of suburbs was the idea of building the garden city, the Ebenezer Howard idea, that you could have a place where you live and work and where the scale was human scale. And Interestingly enough, the city that really perfected that idea was Los Angeles. Los Angeles was not built to be another New York. It was built to be a series of small, semi-autonomous communities, which were which had their own sort of downtowns, their own identity. It wasn't everything on the center, and then that was part of the success of LA and part of the attraction of LA. Is part of the sort of multipolarity of LA, which allowed lots of different people to do really interesting things. So you have, even today, I write about it in the book, about the San Gabriel Valley and the change. San Gabriel Valley was kind of dying when I first got here in the mid-70s. It's been reanimated by this movement, particularly of Asians, into the San Gabriel Valley, creating an incredibly diverse and incredibly dynamic economy. And I think what we have to realize is that the suburbs still are where the vast majority of people in the metropolitan area live. And then the question is, how do we make them economically and environmentally sustainable? And there are several key areas of that. One is the idea of dispersion of work. The idea that everyone's going into a center core is never going to happen in Los Angeles. About 2.5% of the people in the LA region work in downtown LA. I mean, it just isn't that significant. In comparison, New York is about 20%. The other thing that's really critical, if you want to think about the future of the suburbs, is how we can increase the number of people telecommuting. We have about 36 million telecommuters to now. By around 2016, we'll be up around 63 million. This is an enormous energy saving. It's a way of re-knitting families. My image is of the Dutch family of the 17th century, where the upstairs, the family lived, and the downstairs was where business took place. And this unity of the family and business. And these are things that LA is natural for. You know, we have this wonderful climate. We have, you know, this ability to be very flexible about our life because the weather really allows us a great deal of freedom. We have this ethnic diversity. We have all these creative industries. And many of those are run out of their house. I live in a neighborhood called Valley Village. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. And in my neighborhood, I ride my bike pretty much every day. And what amazes me is I could take my bike out at 9, and it's no more crowded than taking a bike out at 11. In other words, there isn't this idea that we have of the suburb. Everybody leaves at 8 and comes back at 5 or 6. Actually, a huge percentage of the people in my neighborhood and in many suburbs commute very close by or work at home. And I think that's where we want to go over time. There is nothing, you know, great or noble about the long-distance commute. Some people have to do it, but it is not really where we want to go. So I think of, I use the term in the book, the archipelago of villages, a bunch of separate villages. And, of course, the one that is actually the lead example is Valencia, which is right here.
And Santa Clarita, very complimentary there. I was fascinated, too, Joel, the way you chronicle people resorting to technology, creating web communities in suburbs and even in Brooklyn, the family you talk about, of like-minded. For instance, mothers with small children, you get on the web and suddenly there's 746 mothers with small children sharing information about taking care of children in that community, et cetera. And that was a wonderful a combination of technology and some of the trends you're talking about.
Well, if you take a look at here in the Southern California area, there's a website called Peachhead, which my wife goes on all the time. And this is where they share information about if you need something for your house or what are the good parks to go to, what kind of events are taking place where you could take your kids, all the gossip about which schools are better to go to. There's really kind of this new networking among people. And this can take place in a rural area or in an urban neighborhood. The one I profile is where my father grew up, Flatbush in Brooklyn, New York. This was the Flatbush family a network, and they really served this purpose that doesn't replace the church, but certainly replaces in many ways what the Kiwanis and the Rotary and the traditional clubs did. And it's a fantastic mechanism for building the new community that as we get to be a more complex, larger, more diverse society, we're going to need.
Well, one of the things that also interested me when you talk about family, it's you acknowledge the nuclear family, but you talk about the extended family, multi-generational family. One of your chapters is on the coming of the three-generational house. And you also talk about created families, unconventional families, where people will link up with other people and form, in effect, not in effect, but form family units. So your attitude is very inclusive towards what family formation is.
Well, one of the things I learned, and this is in the sixth chapter of the book, which I felt I learned the most at writing, is that there's a wonderful historian of Stephanie Kuntz who writes about family, and we think of the 50s as sort of the base that is the norm, but it turns out the 50s were not the norm. The 50s were an exceptional period. People had put off child rearing during the Depression, World War II. They came back from the war and they were popping out babies at an incredibly rapid rate, and they were moving to the suburbs, which they were now able to do. And of course, it's no mistake, and I mentioned this in the book, that the greatest person to start this, William Levitt, was a CB and had learned how to do this during the Second World War. So what I think we have to keep in mind is that people really are looking for a way of life that is that has connections with other human beings. And the critical nature of American society is how strong are what Jefferson called the little republics, the little associations. De Tocqueville writes about this beautifully. Whether it's a club, association, a website, a farmer's markets. There are now farmer's markets all over Los Angeles. These are gathering points.
Or people just getting together for coffee, like you say, in the morning, older people that get to go to the same little coffee shop and talk and kibitz, et cetera.
And what's interesting is, if you go back before the 50s, families were very flexible in the same way. One of the reasons is, one, immigration. A lot of the immigrants ended up with very broken families. A lot of times a child would come and stay with an aunt or uncle. The movement west, people died. Sometimes the 15-year-old came out and stayed with a distant relative in another part of the country. And I think we're starting to see that this is really the norm of the family, and we are now rediscovering that norm, which is the role I see in several families, including my own, the people without children, the uncles, aunts, playing a very, very critical role in the lives of their brothers and sisters' children. Grandparents playing an important role. And I try to discuss how we're going to have a situation where the parents, some ways, take care of their parents, but their parents take care of the kids. And, of course, there's Judy Markowitz's quote in Queens. She said, in Manhattan, they have nannies. In Queens, we have grandparents.
Well, Joel, we hear a lot about the culture wars. Bill O'Reilly, Fox News, that uses that category a lot, that America has two cultures that are at war with each other, one more or less described, that you've described very, very well in this book, and the other meaning being urban intellectuals, et cetera, et cetera. But you say in the book that that culture war is easing up. It's not as intense as it used to be.
No, first of all, Barack Obama would not be president of the United States if it hadn't changed somewhat. But the other thing that I think is absolutely critical is that Americans are, when I go out and speak, and I speak all over the country in Mobile, Alabama, or in Houston, or in the Great Plains, as well as in New York or Los Angeles, I don't think people are preoccupied with these culture war issues. I think there are people who exploit this for their own advantage, and both in the political world and the media world. But fundamentally, I find that most people who you might consider very liberal, they still care about their kids, they care about their neighborhoods, they may or may not go to a church. They're neighbors just like conservative people are. And I think that that this culture wars, which I think was very cynically exploited by both sides, by the people who would indicate that everybody on the other side hated gay people or hated minorities, And the people who on the other side thought that the people on the other side hated religion and hated their country. And I find that most people are really amazingly practical. They care about basic things, infrastructure, quality of education, safety, and more than anything else, they want the ability to make decisions for themselves. They don't want the state telling them how to live, and that's the essence of being an American.
Well, that's a wonderful side, very heartening side of the book. You also make and you come back to it a number of times in the book, make the distinction between, because this is allied to this, race and class. And whereas you're very optimistic that racial distinctions are beginning to ameliorate, you also say that class divisions tend to be hardening in the culture.
Huge change. You know, I remember telling my 15-year-old, I said, you know, Ariel, when I first went to Washington in 1959, my parents were driving, we were driving down there, and I saw a sign that said colored. And I said, what is that? And it was a hotel for colored people. There were restaurants for colored people. And she said, you know, she said, no way. And of course, I, being a San Fernando Valley dad, said, yes, way. This is inconceivable. I mean, I sometimes think that if you took somebody from 1959 or 1960 and transported them to our society today, they would be shocked at the level of interracial dating, interracial concourse. Americans have a very high percentage who are, you know, either they're dating or they're friends. You go to a restaurant in Los Angeles very often, you'll see mixed race groups of people all the time. Compared to 20, 30 years ago, or particularly 40, 50 years ago, huge, huge change in the racial attitudes among millennials, the people born after 83. About 95% approve of interracial dating. Among people over 65, it's only 45%.
And you quote the 2000 census to this effect. About the younger you get towards 18, the more the lines there disappear. And that'll be interesting to see in the 2010 census what this reveals. But what about class? How racial or ethnic differences can be discerned? What is class? Is it the accent, as in England, or is it educational pedigree, or is it strictly affluence? What are these class barriers you're talking about?
Well, in the book, I say the biggest challenge we have as a country is, as our population grows, we need about 125,000 jobs a month that we have to create. We're obviously not doing that now. If we go the way we could go, and I look at the work I'm doing in the UK as sort of, you know, if I want to scare myself, and I say, what's happened to the indigenous white working class of the United Kingdom? And it is a scary thing to see. I mean, it really, where people have said, you know, I'm never going to get anywhere. I'm going to try to live off the state as best I can. There's a huge part of the UK where the pubs are the basic economy. That's really what there is. And we could go down that road. And I think the class divisions will become the big determining factor. And America is about upward mobility. And if we lose that, then this future that I'm talking about is going to be not going to happen. And I think now what I do see happening politically is I think the president, after some major missteps, is beginning to realize that jobs and upward mobility are the issue. And whichever political party identifies itself with economic growth and job creation and upward mobility, that will be the party that will be dominant in the next 20, 30 years.
Well, if there's any class bias in this book, and I mean it in a positive sense, it's the middle class. You're very concerned about middle class America, its survival. And you cite any number of cases where it's in trouble.
Well, the middle class, particularly in urban areas, places like Los Angeles and New York have the fewest percentage of middle class neighborhoods out of all their neighborhoods. You have the very wealthy and then the very poor. And this is something that is absolutely at the heart of our democracy, because small property ownership is at the core of the constitutional order of the United States, if we go back to Madison. And it's the middle class that makes a city run. These are the people who turn out to vote. These are the people who own the small businesses. And you can already see in Los Angeles that there was a period where we had this thriving small business economy. And that group was after 1993, was a group that elected Dick Reardon as mayor. I'm not sure Dick Reardon could be elected mayor anymore. I think that the number of people who are either out of the system, dependent on the state one way or the other, work for the government, and the people who are so wealthy it doesn't matter to them, that may be now the majority, and that would be a shame for Los Angeles. But in the country as a whole, still the middle class is pretty predominant. But I think there are many, many threats to it, and the country has to be reignited in terms of its infrastructure and its shift back to what I would call productive industries and being a competitive country. Or we can play the game that we've been playing, which is dominated by finance and asset speculation, and you'll see the class lines get much wider.
Well, Joel, you argue that this 100 million, which certain types of people would say, oh, isn't that terrible? And your argument back is, well, it's going to happen. You see it very positively as recruits for the middle class, provided that the economy the American economy gets back to doing real things, making real things, or even answering the phone. You mentioned this one, city, I forget, it was in Iowa, or it was somewhere.
In Iowa, yeah.
It was Iowa, where it outbid India to get jobs on telephone answering.
Yeah, actually, last time I was in Fargo, there was a guy from India trying to figure out how to set up an office there for software support. So
it gets people from Fargo to answer telephone calls from India.
That's right. So you have some guy in Fargo trying to sound like he's Indian. Yes, I'm Anil.
But would you say something about this industrial economy? Because certainly that's our most embattled sector, and yet the willingness of the American people in general to try and help bail out General Motors suggests that we still have that deep down base. We want to still be a people who make things.
Well, and you go to certain parts of the country, not just Houston, but Mobile, Alabama, Savannah, Georgia, certainly many parts of the Great Plains. There's a desire to rebuild this industrial base that we have. It won't be necessarily the same product lines, but I think that there is a desire to do this. You know, here in Los Angeles, the amazing economy that we had up until the last 10 years, where we had this incredibly diversified industrial base, which allowed for wealth creation, new wealth, new companies, many of them run by immigrants, and of course a tremendous growth of working class and middle class jobs as people went up the ladder. I see this less and less, particularly here in LA, and to some extent in New York as well. And this is going to cause incredible problems if we don't deal with it.
But you see it more and more elsewhere.
Yes, although I think a lot of places are looking, you know, where they used to look at California as a role model, now they say this is what we don't want to do.
Joel, we're going to go to questions in about 5 minutes from the audience, but could you just take us on a tour of America optimistically in 2050, and then maybe take us on a tour of America in 2050 if things don't work out.
All right. If we take a look at America in 2050, I'll start with a negative one.
All right.
Because then we can end on a better light. negative vision is very much like the United Kingdom. Lots of wealth in a few places. And now in the UK, it's mostly in London, but it's, of course, a small country. You know, enormous amounts of wealth in San Francisco, in on the west side of Los Angeles, in Manhattan, with those people having very nice vacation homes. Everyone else basically packed in to small apartments, and in some cases small, rather ramshackle houses. People having a very hard time doing anything except hoping to get a job for the government. A country where, under those circumstances, there will be considerable racial problems, anti-immigrant feelings because people will feel very much defensive, and a country that has essentially ceded the future to an authoritarian state such as China, and the world will not be such a pleasant place to be. It will be a very ugly place to be. My positive scenario is that we are a country in which we have revived cities, not just cities like New York, but the places like St. Louis, for instance, which has beautiful neighborhoods and parks that are now almost abandoned, but would be great places for somebody who wanted an urban lifestyle. Suburbs that are more and more self-contained, families that are more and more working out of their homes and you know, conserving energy and spending more time with each other. I have this concept of localism in which people identify very much with their local areas and do things in their local areas, and a heartland that has been somewhat repopulated and very vital, and a country that looks out at the future and says, you know, we can be a great and dominant and preeminent country without having to go to war with everybody. We are a country that our leadership and our culture is the true global culture, is the multiracial superpower on Earth, and that no other country in the world, certainly no large country, has anything like it. That's the positive future, and I'm, you know, very interested in how people want to get to that future, but I tried to lay it out where I think we can go, and hopefully others will help us get there.
Joel, you don't mention this. Perhaps you think it's either another book or an impossible case. Could you sketch out? There's so much discussion about California, where we are now. You mentioned Los Angeles quite a bit in your commentary today because you're living here and you've written so beautifully about Los Angeles. The narrative in California, could you do the same thing, negatively, what happens to California? And I know it's going to be difficult for you because I read you, your column, and you're pretty pessimistic about California. But how about the optimistic, where we recover momentum and get our act together?
Well, I think California right now on the negative side has lost the very innovative spirit of in the sense of building the infrastructure that we need. I was driving from Sonoma down to through San Francisco, and the roads were worse than the ones in Mexico City. I mean, it was an embarrassment. I mean, if I had a foreign friend, I would have been embarrassed. I mean, they were in terrible shape. We have a mentality in the state where we don't build any new power plants. We don't build any new, we don't build new water systems. There's no vision. You know, where is, you know, the legacy of our great governor, Pat Brown? You know, we only get his less than perfect son. And this notion of that I see, which is almost a generational conflict, where wealthy, affluent boomers living in places that the average middle-class person no longer can afford. I was doing a talk show with Pat Morrison today, and this woman was 75 years old, said, yeah, I bought my house in Manhattan Beach when regular people could live here. I thought that was a very revealing comment. And a very class bifurcated state with perennial problems in its budget, only occasionally bailed out by asset bubbles. So that's my negative. The positive is that somehow we find new leadership in this state. I think the most important issue is, will our emerging Latino Asian majority realize that the current policies that are being promulgated are absolutely detrimental to their future, and that they will embrace a new vision that is neither the kind of silly vision of the liberal Democrats or the regressive vision of the conservative Republicans. California, as Kevin has written about more than anyone, and has had great political innovation. We've a state that has created nonpartisan or bipartisan leadership, and we have to get back to that. And I hope we do, because right now this state is no longer the state that I thought of 25 years ago as the leader of the country.
Joel, how could such a dysfunctional state, so dysfunctional in its public dimension, be the eighth or ninth largest economy on the planet?
Well, you know, there's something called inertia. You know, we created the perfect formula: great infrastructure, great universities. We used to actually have good public schools, and we developed the world's best agricultural network. We built. I mean, even in the time that I moved to Los Angeles under Tom Bradley, we built the port of L.A. into the dominant port of North America. So that what we're right now, we're really trading on the past, and we're getting to a point where the past is getting a little old. You know, I always think about it when you drive around, particularly in the valley, and you're starting to see the water main breaks. And I said, well, what's that about? And I said, well, you know what? These water mains
been there 60, 70 years,
right? And it's beginning to fall apart. Somehow that spirit has to be rekindled. And you know, I was mentioning to Kevin, I feel a little bit depressed about this. Is that I was very engaged in Los Angeles for a good part of my life, particularly after the 1992 riots, and now I find that with a few exceptions, there's no one left to talk to. There's no one who seems to be sharing a vision of a California that's not only prosperous, but a place of upward mobility and aspiration.
Well, a lot of people are saying that, Joel, and they're pointing to a locally owned and revivified Los Angeles Times as part of the solution.
Well, certainly a different ownership of the Times would not be the worst thing that could happen.
Well, we have time for questions now, and I think there's a microphone there that please raise your hand and go ahead, sir. I'll just say who's first. I saw you first. Thank you.
Okay. I know your subject is the United States, but I assume that the growth you're projecting for the United States is going to be mirrored in the world, and we're going to be up around 9 billion people.
Yes.
In the world around 2050.
Yes.
And that's a lot of people, and we have resource problems everywhere, and we sort of have an economy and a state of mind that says everything has to get 3% better every year, or we have a recession or a crisis or something like that. And you kind of decried Italy and Japan because they're at zero population growth, but we've got to get used to that. The whole world's got to get used to it. And we can't just go on growing forever. It's not sustainable.
Well,
period.
Okay, first of all, let's start with the fact that if you take a look at the numbers, Paul Ehrlich was unbelievably off target. You know, he was he had the idea that there'd be mass starvation in the third world. John Holdren, the science advisor to the current president, wrote in the mid-80s that the developing countries would never have economic progress because there wouldn't be enough resources. Shows how much he knew. There's this place called China. You know, something's actually happened there. I was just in India, and they have some malls nicer than the ones here. So I think that what we're looking at, and I think that we're in a very interesting period in world history, and that, thinking about it for the next book. So you go from 2010 to 2050, the population, global population, has really dropped to what is really a sustainable level, which is about two kids per household. Huge drops in the population of a lot of the developing countries. Mexico is going to be very close to the U.S. in terms of its fertility rate. So we have this period between now and 2050 where we'll have this population. After that, it stops growing. Something that was never anticipated in the 20 or 30 years ago, that when people urbanize and get educated and women go in the workforce, the birth rate goes down fairly dramatically. So the question is, how do we get from 2010 to 2050? Because that's, you know, as they used to say in Little Italy, you know, the pie's in the oven already. It's already happening. So how do we prepare for that? And I would say the biggest challenge, and there's certainly going to be environmental challenges, but I think human beings are amazingly adaptable, and I think we've managed to get around a lot of the predicted shortages that we thought. Mass starvation didn't happen. Peak oil hasn't happened. You know, we're pretty inventive species. But this next 40 years, what I worry about is what Marx wrote about the whole rising expectations. If they're not fulfilled, whether in the United States or in these developing countries, in terms of the Japanese or European model of, you know, where you start having negative growth, the problem with really negative growth is you have a lot of old people and not a lot of young people to do the work. And first of all, fiscally, it's an absolute disaster. And as a society, it's a disaster. You know, you go to parts of Western Europe now and you walk around and you don't see children. I think that's kind of sad. And I think it's economically doesn't work very well. And what's really interesting, I used to think, well, if you didn't have a lot of kids and there were only a few kids, then those kids would be more valued and they would have leverage because they'd be a rare commodity. But what happens is a society is like an organism. If, in the case of Japan, let's say, 40% of the population is over 65 by 2050, all the power in the society is going to be oriented towards servicing that part of the population. That's why you have such extremely high youth unemployment rates in many European countries. And you say, well, your labor force isn't growing. Why do you have high youth unemployment? Because the entire system is devised to help the boomers and the older people. So, you know, there's an equilibrium that you want to reach. And I think that we will hit that point, I think, around 2050. And by the way, the same thing's true of the United States. We'll sort of peak our population around 2050, unless we have a massive increase in immigration.
Yes, please, and then we'll come back to you. Thanks.
Speaking of California, how can we ever expect this state to get better when we have this terrible mantra of no new taxes? Lower my taxes. I get so sick of it. What's wrong with paying taxes to make a better place to live?
Okay. All right. I pay taxes also. But let me put it this way. I think one reason for this mantra is people don't want to pay taxes so that people can retire at the age of 55 on 90% of their salary with a pension that is infinitely better than theirs. If people felt, and this is something that I would say to the state and I would say to the federal government, I think Americans would be willing to pay taxes if they knew at the end of it they were going to get something that was a huge improvement. Okay, like for instance, you think of the legacy of the WPA. I urged President Obama to bring the WPA back. We have roads that are falling apart. We have things that we can't fix. Yet we have an enormous group of people in their early 20s who are unemployed, have no skills. Why don't we take those people, pay them $12 an hour, give them the minimal health care because they don't really need very much at that age, and have them rebuild America? Well, I think the same thing. Now, I think most Americans and most Californians would support that. What they don't want to support is a privileged class of public employees who have it infinitely better than they do in many ways, who retire at 55 while they work till they're 70. That is not sustainable politically. So I blame the Republicans for being greedy and selfish, and I blame the Democrats for being greedy and selfish. They're both servicing different groups.
Sir, over down this way, and then we'll go up to. Oh, and I'll get back there. We'll come. Then we'll move back in that direction. Just before you ask your question, Sean, I want to say, Joel, as somebody who, to include my 2 years in the Army, had 17 years on the public payroll, you've kind of hurt my feelings.
I'm sorry.
And in fact, as a state librarian for 10 years, I got a wonderful big pension from the state. I tell people that my wife and I could live on my pension if we were in a tent in Trinity County.
My question is similar to the last question, and that is, how do you foresee the middle class being able to thrive again, considering what seems to be a stranglehold that affluence and corporations have on the government?
Well, I think it's something that both parties are afflicted with. I mean, after all, you know, Tim Geithner couldn't be a bigger lackey of Wall Street than anyone that the Republicans could have had. You know, Kevin knows this. I'm, you know, underneath this somewhat conservative exterior lies the heart of a Bolshevik. And you can tell from my last name that that's not completely a joke. But the fact of the matter is, the American people are going to have to say, we don't want this government, this sort of corporate government. We want to have a government, though, we don't want a government that functions for the benefit of the public employee unions or the Chicago machine either. And that's part of the problem that we have. Again, I think that if Governor Schwarzenegger or President Obama got up there and said, we're going to have these regulations, and I'm in favor of bringing back Glass-Steagall and the regulations on the banks. You know, we're going to have an economic policy which is going to encourage industry, that's going to encourage entrepreneurship, that's going to encourage research and development. And it may be that you may have more taxes on consumption and less on production. I think there'd be a strong consensus for that. I really do. And by the way, I find that when I do conservative talk radio, I'm one of these weird people who does NPR and conservative talk radio, and I can tell you there's a lot of agreement among conservative people that we need to do this as well. The bailouts that have gone on are the single most universally unpopular thing I have seen in my entire life.
In the back, up in this direction here, we sort of, there you are, sir, good.
I'm not too sanguine about the California state government because of the whole construct and the gerrymandering. So because you live in Los Angeles County, there's a little bit, I think, more flexibility to make some changes. What two or three things could we do, LA County, LA City, that could have an impact within the next few years, not long term?
Okay, probably, again, I'm not as involved in L.A. as, you know, 10 years ago I would have had a good list for you. One thing is obviously got to be a more business-friendly environment. Individual entrepreneurs will tell you they completely avoid being in the city of L.A. if they possibly can. You know, if they're in the garment industry, they're going to go to Vernon. Even some sort of technology industry, they might go to Culver City. They go to Calabasas. You know, Burbank, which is a great success story in many ways. You know, when I drive from my house in North Hollywood and I'm going down Burbank Boulevard and on the streets in L.A., it's like a third world country. I get to Burbank, all of a sudden the streets are paved. So some of the very basic functions of government need to come back. The regulatory environment in the city of Los Angeles, by everyone I know who studied it, is among the worst in the country and certainly in the state. And then obviously something has to be done about the education system, and a lot has been tried. And I have two young daughters, my youngest, we looked and looked and looked, and we found one or two elementary schools that we thought might be good, and we couldn't get in. And so she's now going to Heschel in Northridge, and we're very happy with it. But you know, we were able to scrape the money together to do that. For other people, the choice is to get out of town. So I think that what you need is a greater focus on the middle class, greater focus on the productive economy, greater focus on the infrastructure, and then some basic reform in the school district. There's people who know much more about that, but these are obvious things. Because when you ask people, why are you leaving, the schools are probably at the top of the list. Not taxes, schools, regulations.
We had here in the there was a lady here. Or,
sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
Given that politicians and government deal with the immediate and not the important, because of the need to pander to the next election, what kinds of things do you think will motivate or push us in the positive direction that you've outlined in your book?
Well, I think it's going to be a lot of community involvement. And here I'm going to say something that's completely bizarre and I've never said publicly. I'm one of the few people who think that both the election of Barack Obama and the Tea Parties are a good idea at the same time. Now, why would I say something so bizarre? Because they both express a grassroots desire for some sort of change. You know, you don't have Tea Party movements in Europe. You have organized movements by organized groups that are very scripted. You would not have the election of someone like Barack Obama against the Clinton machine, against well-organized opposition. We're going to need a lot more of that. We're going to need a lot more of people saying, I've had enough of this, and we're going to change it, and not to be so passive. I think the passivity of the American people is their greatest enemy.
Well, Joe, from that point of view, you're not a Bolshevik, you're a Trotskyite.
Okay. Well, my great uncle knew Trotsky, so, okay.
Yes, sir. And then we'll go back up to the area there.
As far as the state of California goes, in order to make it a functioning political state again so that you can get some of these movements forward, do you think it will take a revision of our state constitution to keep up with the times?
It may not be the worst idea, but certainly some very basic things. And I'll admit, I favored term limits. I think they've been a disaster. You get the sort of Stepford legislators, you know, they come in and they disappear and they're replaced by others. The other thing is the redistricting. And at some point, we're going to have to do something about the power of the public employee unions. They have, you know, both Franklin Roosevelt and Fiore LaGuardia warned against this, because you have a group of people who are organized, they're in the bureaucracy, they have tremendous power and leverage, and in a society in which trade unions on the private side have gotten much weaker, they now dominate the union movement, particularly here in California. I've been a union member myself in AFSTRA, and I come from a line of people who have been in unions, and the public sector unions are a completely different phenomenon, because the difference is the private sector union sometimes could be destructive but has a interest in the overall economy. The public sector unions don't have that same interest. They should, but they don't. So I think there's some structural changes that are going to have to happen. You can't have a situation where one of the political parties is completely controlled by people who are supposed to work for us and make it that we work for them.
Please, up in this area here.
Hi. Thank you so much, first of all.
Thank you.
Kind of going more to the cultural zeitgeist than policy side, I was wondering, and this might be a question for Mr. Starr, too, because the California dream is something you've pretty much helped define, not only just write eloquently about, but for so long, this idea, this kind of manifest destiny, go west, young man ethos has been such a part of our national consciousness of California being this kind of dream state where you can reinvent yourself, upward mobility, anything can happen. And, sorry, am I doing something? As all that infrastructure stuff kind of gets outdated and we no longer have the public education system, we no longer have kind of any of that upward mobility, how do you think that will affect how California is seen and that kind of boosterism of it?
Okay. Right now, I have to say that I don't advertise actively that I come from Los Angeles, in the sense that it has no cachet, it has less cachet, except in the middle of the winter. California's lost its mojo. You know, it's lost its, you know, we were talking about it, the muse of California, the to express what was happening here in the 60s, 70s, 80s, where California was coming, and particularly Los Angeles, coming out of being Tinseltown to being this sort of artistic center, architectural center of the country, intellectual center of the country. We've sort of we're not in our best position on that right now. Can it come back? Yeah, I think it can come back. I think we did recover from a much more severe period, I believe, in the early 90s, but we had better leadership in the 90s than we have now at the legislative level and at the governor's level. But in California, that mystique is still here, but it's becoming more attenuated as the state's troubles seem to be more evident. But I think here's one thing where I do think California is going to be very important. As we become a multiracial country, this will be the laboratory. And what's happening, not so much in L.A., but in the suburbs of in Riverside, in San Gabriel Valley, in the San Fernando Valley, this experiment with the multiracial society, that's something where California really has an edge up. And that can be expressed in culture, it could be expressed in literature, it could be expressed in how we, you know, what we eat, even the cuisine that comes out of California. So in that area, I think we have great potential. And maybe what we need is we need us boomers to step aside a little and let the next generation take the helm, because we certainly screwed it up.
Well, one more question. Sir, please.
Thank you. Hello, Minnesota, for the podcast. As an economist, I can't resist asking this simple question. Going back to the TARP plan, if the government gave every single American $1 million from the TARP plan, free and clear, would that actually help the situation that we're in into the future, or would it simply be a waste of the money?
Well, I can think of a better way. A, you don't necessarily have to run up the debt. And the second thing is, there are things that we could be doing and we could be building. I'll give you something that had a big effect on me. I worked a lot in Houston during the Katrina situation. And when I did the interviews, the idea struck me. I said, here's a city that's been destroyed. All these people have moved. Many of the young people had no skills. Why didn't we take the people of New Orleans and bring them to New Orleans and teach them to rebuild their own city? I think that would have been a better use of our resources. So I keep going back to this, but you know, when you drive through Los Angeles and, you know, San Francisco, we did on my website, newgeography.com, we went through this, and all the things that were built that were left to us from the 1930s by the WPA, and even all the way through Eisenhower, and certainly with Pat Brown, we're leaving nothing for the next generation. We were given an enormous bounty by the previous generation, and we've kind of squandered it, and we haven't modernized it. And I think that would be where I would have spent the money. And, you know, frankly, the money that went into the pockets of the banks was an outrage.
Well, Joel, I'll just conclude with you mentioned the crisis of California in the early 90s. The Los Angeles, the Times, the news actually was that it was in the news. A man and a woman had left in the early 90s, had gone to Idaho, and they came back, and they went back to San Diego, and they bought their home more or less in a similar area and neighborhood. At a greater expense, et cetera, because this inflation of housing you're talking about that occurred in the state. And the reporter asked the woman, saying, well, why'd you come back? Why'd you come back to California? And she said, you can't get good takeout in Idaho. When I first heard that, I felt depressed because I said I spent 40 years in the library, ruined my eyesight, writing 8 volumes on the history of California. And she said it better in one sentence than I was. That's what I was trying to say. Now, having read your book, Joel, I know you can get good takeout in Idaho and North Dakota, Fargo, and all places in between. And from that point of view, the California's ordeal, that its current ordeal, is also on behalf of the rest of the nation, that there is still a quality of bellwether state, and that can move in positive or negative directions, that our current ordeal is testing and maybe even will serve as a warning sign to other states what to avoid.
I think.
Well, thank you so much, Joel Kotkin. And
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.